imagine you're walking down a street in Kolkata. You know, the sounds, the smells are all around you. You look up, and the city's skyline really tells a story. You've got these grand old buildings right next to modern high-rises, some still going up, others looking like they've stood for ages.
It's quite a mix, isn't it?
It really is. And you have to wonder, what unseen forces, what sort of intricate web of rules dictates how these structures rise and sometimes, well, how they have to come down? Today, we're taking a deep dive into precisely that, the complex world of building regulations and demolition in Kolkata. We'll be focusing mainly on the Kolkata Municipal Corporation Act of 1980, which we'll just call the KMC Act for simplicity.
Sounds good.
Our mission really is to unpack this pretty intricate legal framework, understand why it exists, and figure out how it impacts everyone from, you know, huge developers down to you, the everyday resident.
And to help us navigate this, we're drawing on a really comprehensive legal analysis. It's the kind of source that doesn't just list laws. It digs into the procedures, the specific legal points, and even the judicial remedies available. It gives some very practical insights into how this all actually works on the ground.
Exactly. Because look, this isn't just some dry legal topic for lawyers. It's fundamentally about understanding how a major city like Kolkata manages its growth, how it tries to ensure safety, and how it balances that with the rights of its citizens. So let's get into it.
Okay.
So to really get a handle on how buildings are built and managed in Kolkata, we first need to understand the foundation, which is this KMC Act of 1980.
It really is the backbone, yeah.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
It replaced an older act from 1951, and the reason for that change tells you a lot about its purpose. It was a direct response to what the documents call the growing complexities of urban challenges and, well, frankly, a proliferation of unauthorized construction.
Really a major issue.
It clearly was. So the spirit behind this newer act is all about public benefit, planned development, and crucially, structural safety.
And what's really interesting about the Act when you look closely is how it defines things. The definitions are deliberately broad, very comprehensive.
Right.
And that's not accidental. It feels like a conscious legislative strategy. The idea is to prevent developers or owners from finding narrow loopholes, you know, trying to argue their specific project doesn't quite fit a tight definition. This broadness casts a wide net.
So it makes it harder to argue you didn't need permission for something.
Precisely. It makes it genuinely challenging for unauthorized constructions to claim exemption based on some technicality.
Okay, so the big takeaway here for you, our listener, is that the KMC isn't just thinking about brand new skyscrapers. Their legal definitions are so wide-ranging, they catch everything from adding a tiny room to, like you said, even just changing a staircase. Let's take to erect a building under Section 390. It's way broader than you'd think.
Much broader.
Yeah. You'd assume it just means building something new from scratch. But no, it includes re-erecting a building if, say, more than half of it was destroyed.
Like after a fire or something.
Exactly. Or converting a structure not originally meant for people to live in into a dwelling. Or taking a single house and turning it into multiple flats.
Or even the other way around, converting multiple units into fewer.
Right. Roofing an open space between walls, that counts. Converting a non-commercial building for commercial or industrial use, that's in there too. Making any addition to an existing building.
Any addition. That's key.
It really is. And get this, even permanently closing a door or window in an outside wall, or removing or reconstructing the main staircase or changing its position, all of that falls under erecting a building.
It's incredibly comprehensive. Mm-hmm. And that same broad approach applies to the word building itself. It's not just the main structure. It covers parts of buildings, verandas, balconies, roofs, chimneys.
So basically anything attached.
Pretty much. The analysis we're looking at even points out that things without a roof, like a swimming pool or even an underground petrol storage tank, have been legally considered buildings in court cases.
Wow. Okay, so that really shows the scope. And then there's the term alteration.
Which, again, is quite broad. It includes structural changes, adding or removing walls, columns, beams, that sort of thing, or even just changing the building's occupancy.
How it's used, basically.
Exactly. An occupancy or use group is another layer of classification. There are about 9 categories: residential, educational, institutional, assembly, business, mercantile, industrial, storage, hazardous. This is all about zoning and making sure the building's use fits the plan for that area.
So the reason this groundwork on definitions is so vital for you, our listener, is because it determines if your project, maybe a small extension or even changing how you use a room in your business, falls under the KMC's scrutiny. It goes far beyond just putting up four walls and a roof.
Absolutely. It sets the stage for everything that follows in terms of needing permission.
Okay, so we've established just how broadly the KMC defines building and related activities. Now, how do you actually get permission to do any of this stuff in Kolkata? The KMC Act lays out a pretty strict path.
It does. Section 392 is fundamental here. It states very clearly that no person can erect or even commence work without first obtaining the explicit sanction of the municipal commissioner.
Explicit sanction. Not implied, not assumed.
Explicit. And it highlights how seriously they take this. Even putting up a boundary wall over 2 meters high without sanction is not allowed. That's quite a low threshold.
It shows they want oversight, even on relatively minor things. So what does the application process itself involve?
It's quite detailed. You need to submit a written notice, pay the required fees, provide the document of title for the land, basically proving you own it or have the right to build on it.
Makes sense.
You also need a declaration related to the Urban Land Sealing and Regulation Act of 1976. Now, that act is mostly repealed, but its legacy means you still often have to declare things related to it.
Interesting how older laws still echo.
Yes. And of course, you need comprehensive plans, location plans, site plans, building plans, very detailed stuff. And a crucial point to remember is that the rules that apply are generally those in force when the order is passed, not necessarily when you first applied.
So the rules could potentially change mid-process.
They could, which adds a layer of uncertainty sometimes.
And speaking of process, there's been a shift towards online submissions, hasn't there? Section 393A. That feels like more than just modernization.
Oh, definitely. It was a strategic move, particularly aimed at enhancing efficiency and transparency, yes, but also closing a loophole.
What loophole was that?
Under the older 1951 Act, there was a concept of deemed sanction. If the authorities didn't respond within a certain time, you could sometimes assume you had permission. The online system explicitly prevents this.
How so?
An online plan is not considered sanctioned unless it's explicitly certified as duly uploaded by the competent authority. There's no automatic approval anymore just because time passed. It significantly enhances regulatory control.
Got it. So no more assuming silence means yes. You need that explicit green light. So once you've applied, what are the possible outcomes? Sanction, provisional sanction, or refusal?
Those are the main ones. And the Act says sanction must be granted unless the plan contravenes specific provisions of the Act or its rules.
But there are layers of approval involved, right?
Yeah.
Especially for bigger projects.
Yes. For most buildings, excluding maybe small houses on small plots and heritage buildings, you need prior approval from the mayor and council. That's a significant political and administrative layer. And for heritage properties, the Heritage Conservation Committee has to weigh in.
Okay. And what are common reasons for refusal?
Pretty straightforward things, usually. Contravening the KMC Act or rules, missing necessary details in the application, the plan showing encroachment onto government land, or maybe the site just doesn't have proper access to a street.
And just to reiterate the point about loopholes, no deemed sanction or deemed rejection under this act.
None whatsoever. You get an explicit decision. And here's something really important for listeners to understand, especially if you're a neighbor to a new development. An adjoining property owner has a legitimate right to object.
On what grounds?
If the sanction plan doesn't follow the rules, maybe it builds too close to the boundary, or it's too high, particularly if it infringes on your rights, like your right to light and air, or if it creates what the law calls an actionable nuisance.
So neighbors have a voice in the process if their rights are potentially affected. That's significant. And overseeing much of this technical side is the Municipal Building Committee.
Correct. Section 391 sets this up. It plays a pivotal role and has a diverse membership representatives from the police, fire services, architects, town planners, structural engineers, even the Department of Environment.
That's a lot of different perspectives.
It is. And interestingly, its composition was expanded specifically because of the rise in unauthorized constructions. It shows the Act responding, perhaps reactively, to the challenges the city was facing. It really underscores the level of scrutiny intended for building projects in Kolkata.
It certainly paints a picture of a very thorough, if complex, process.
Absolutely. And once you navigate that sanction process, the rules don't stop there. You then have the Municipal Building Code, under Section 404, which becomes your detailed guide.
The rulebook for the actual construction.
Precisely. Its stated aim is to ensure the security, safety, and convenience of the public. It covers everything from materials to dimensions.
And it gets quite specific, doesn't it? I saw some examples regarding open spaces around buildings.
Very specific. For example, a smaller building, say up to 7 meters high, might need about 1.2 meters of open space at the front and sides and 2 meters at the rear.
Okay, seems reasonable.
But if you're constructing something much taller, say between 20 and 25.5 meters, the requirements jump significantly. You might need 5 meters open on all sides and 6.5 meters at the rear. It scales up with the size and potential impact of the building.
That makes sense. More height, more space needed around it. But you mentioned a really surprising restriction earlier, something about overall height limits.
Yes. That's a relatively recent and quite impactful restriction. For many areas, new buildings are now generally limited to 25.5 meters in height. That's roughly 9 stories.
9 stories? That seems quite low for a major city. Why?
It's primarily due to civil aviation concerns. Kolkata has its main airport, but also smaller flying clubs and airfields. Depending on the location, particularly near flight paths, even a 3-story building might need clearance from the Airport Authority of India, the AAI.
Wow. So it's not just about the building itself, but its impact on airspace.
Exactly. It adds a whole other layer of checks and potential limitations that people might not immediately think about when planning a project. You could have everything else lined up, but if the AAI objects, your height could be capped.
That's a crucial point. But while there are these strict rules, it sounds like there's maybe a bit more flexibility for older, more informal settlement areas. You mentioned Theka, Busti, and Colony Land.
Yes, the rules acknowledge the reality of these areas, which often have very small pre-existing plot sizes. We're talking plots maybe no more than 3 khatas, which is around 2,160 square feet, often much smaller.
Right.
So for these areas, there are certain relaxations. For instance, a small house on a tiny plot, maybe just 7-10 T-tax, that's only 300 to 450 square feet, might only need to leave, say, 1 foot of open space in front, 1 foot on 2 sides and 3 feet at the back.
Much less than the standard rules.
Much less. It shows a kind of nuanced regulatory philosophy, trying to balance safety standards with the existing built environment in these specific contexts. It's a pragmatic policy shift.
Okay. Beyond spaces, what about the structure itself, the integrity?
That's heavily regulated, too. For public buildings and even private houses over 3 stories, soil testing and seismic analysis are mandatory. You have to ensure the ground can take the load and that the design considers earthquake risks.
Essential for safety.
Absolutely. And things like outer pillars or column footings, the base of the main supports, they generally have to be constructed at least 1 meter inside the plot boundary line. You can't build right up to the edge with your main structural elements.
And what about accountability? If something goes wrong structurally?
Section 414 is key here. It mandates engaging qualified technical people, architects, engineers, and crucially, holds them accountable for misconduct that leads to loss of life or property. This was a direct legislative reaction to some tragic building collapses in the past. It puts the onus squarely on the professionals.
So real consequences for negligence.
Definitely. And the code gets even more granular down to specific parts of the building. Like, habitable rooms must have a minimum height of 2.75 meters. Kitchens need a minimum floor area 7.5 square meters, or 9.5 if it includes a dining space. Bathrooms have minimum sizes, need to be waterproofed, have proper drainage.
3B2.
Basements are restricted too, generally only allowed on plots of at least 40 square meters, and the basement area can't exceed half the ground floor area. Even boundary walls have height limits, typically 1.5 to 2.75 meters for residential properties, and need to be set back from the road.
And I assume fire safety is a big part of the code as well.
Huge. There are extensive fire protection requirements, plus special rules for buildings on street corners to ensure visibility, and rules about building near newly laid out streets.
It covers a lot of angles.
It does. Section 407 prohibits using inflammable materials for roofs or external walls without specific permission. And Section 409 gives the commissioner power to immediately stop any excavation if it looks like it might interfere with underground utilities or endanger adjacent structures.
So the level of detail is immense. From room height to boundary walls to fire safety. It really aims to regulate almost every aspect of construction for safety and planning.
That's the goal. It paints a picture of how closely the KMC aims to manage the built environment.
Which brings us to the inevitable question. What happens when someone doesn't follow these incredibly detailed rules? When things go wrong?
Right. So what counts as an irregularity or a deviation? Well, it's essentially any construction work done without or contrary to the sanction, meaning without permission or not following the approved plan or any work that contravenes any provision of the KMC Act, its rules or regulations.
So pretty much anything outside the approved lines.
Exactly. And it covers specific situations, too. For example, building in designated no construction zones, or critically, failing to stop construction immediately if you receive a stop work notice from the KMC.
Ignoring an official order is a violation in itself.
Absolutely. Another key one is if the original sanction was obtained through material misrepresentation or fraudulent statements under Section 397. If that's discovered, the sanction can be canceled, and the entire work is then considered to have been done without any sanction at all.
So lying on your application can invalidate everything later.
Precisely. Other examples include getting sanctioned for work in a common area of a building without getting consent from all the co-owners, or the more common things like unauthorized extensions, adding extra floors or rooms not in the plan, or violating zoning rules like putting a factory in a residential zone.
And the consequences for these kinds of non-compliance?
They are generally quite severe. The default position is that unauthorized constructions are liable to be removed or demolished by the municipality.
No messing around.
Not usually. And the quids have been very clear on this point. Illegally built structures generally cannot be regularized or legalized by a court order. The courts won't step in to legitimize something built against the law.
What about people who bought flats in such buildings?
That's a tough situation. Builders of unauthorized structures might be directed by courts or consumer forums to compensate buyers, often by refunding the cost of the flat, sometimes with interest. But the illegal structure itself remains liable for demolition.
So the main tool the KMC has here is demolition, covered under Section 400.
Yes. Section 400, titled Order of Demolition and Stoppage, is the cornerstone. It empowers the municipal commissioner to order demolition or stoppage if work is commenced, carried on, or completed either without or contrary to the sanction or in contravention of any of the provisions of the KMC Act.
But can they just send in the bulldozers immediately?
No. And this is a crucial procedural safeguard. The law states that no demolition order can be made unless the person affected, the owner or builder, has been given a reasonable opportunity of showing cause why the order shouldn't be made.
So due process is built in.
It is paramount. They have to serve notice, allow the person to respond, maybe attend a hearing. Procedural fairness is key, even when dealing with potentially illegal construction.
Now, I remember you mentioning something about regularizing minor deviations. Is that possible under Section 400?
Yes, the commissioner does have some discretionary power to regularize minor unauthorized erections or minor deviations from the sanctioned plans.
Okay, so there's some leeway.
Some, but, and this is a very important but, the courts have interpreted this power very narrowly. It's permissible only for marginal, insignificant, perhaps accidental violations. It's absolutely not meant for deliberate, reckless, or motivated violations where someone knowingly broke the rule significantly.
So you can't build an extra illegal floor and hope to get it regularized?
Highly unlikely. The principle is that regularization is a rare exception, not the rule. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card for major illegal construction.
Got it. What about situations where there's immediate danger?
Section 400, subsection 8, gives the mayor and council an extraordinary power. If they deem immediate action necessary because the illegal construction poses a danger to human life, water supply, drainage, sewerage, road traffic, or creates a fire hazard, they can order immediate demolition.
Bypassing the usual notice period.
In those urgent, dangerous situations, yes. And the courts have upheld this power as necessary for public safety.
And you mentioned a recent development about how demolitions are actually carried out.
Yes, this is a very practical, on-the-ground change. A recent KMC circular mandates that demolitions must be comprehensive. This means actively smashing ceilings, floors, beams, and columns.
Not just poking holes.
Exactly. The thinking is that previously, some developers might have found it relatively easy to patch up superficial damage and rebuild the illegal parts. Making the demolition truly structural makes rebuilding much harder and more expensive. It shows the KMC adapting its enforcement tactics based on experience.
That definitely sends a stronger message. Are there other enforcement tools besides demolition?
Yes. Section 402 gives the power to require alterations to bring a building or work into conformity with the rules. This can be a less drastic step than full demolition if the violation is correctable.
And what about old buildings that become unsafe?
That's covered by a different section, Section 411, which deals specifically with the demolition of old, infirm, or dangerous buildings. The focus here is purely on the building's structural condition and safety, not whether it was originally built legally or illegally.
So that's about present danger, not past violations.
Correct. And under Section 411, subsection 4, if a building is deemed imminently dangerous based on an architect's report, the commissioner can take immediate action, even removing occupants summarily if necessary, and recover the costs from the owner.
Serious powers for dangerous structures.
Very serious. And Section 412 complements this, allowing the commissioner to order occupants to vacate a building if it's dangerous, lacks adequate fire exits, or if its use contravenes the sanction rules, particularly impacting fire safety.
And finally, even after a building is legally built, there's one more step, right? The completion certificate.
Yes. Under Section 403, no one can legally occupy or allow occupation of a newly erected building until the municipal commissioner has granted permission, usually in the form of a completion or occupancy certificate. This confirms the building was built according to the sanction plan and is fit for use.
So it's the final check. This whole section really lays bare the significant enforcement powers the KMC wields, trying to balance swift action against violations with that crucial element of due process.
It's a constant balancing act dealing with the persistent challenge of illegal construction.
So if you're on the receiving end of one of these demolition or alteration orders, what can you actually do? What are the legal avenues?
Well, the primary first port of call established by the Act itself is an appeal to the Municipal Building Tribunal.
Yes,
this is set up under Section 415, and Section 400, subsection 3, explicitly mentions the right to appeal a demolition order to this tribunal.
Okay, so there's a dedicated body to hear appeals. Is there a time limit?
Yes. You typically have 30 days from the date of the order to file your appeal. The tribunal has the power to hear the case, and importantly, it can grant stay orders pausing the demolition while the appeal is being heard. Though, if the building work is incomplete, they might require you to provide some form of surety or security deposit to grant that stay.
And are the tribunal's decisions final?
Within the statutory framework, yes. Their orders are considered final and conclusive.
What about situations where the original building sanction itself was dodgy, like obtained through fraud?
Oh, that's covered by Section 397. If it's proven that a sanction was obtained through material misrepresentation or fraudulent statements, the commissioner can cancel that sanction. And once the sanction is canceled, any work done is automatically deemed to have been done without sanction.
Which opens the door for demolition under Section 400.
Exactly. It unwinds the whole process back to square one.
Now, even though the tribunal's decision is described as final, can you challenge it further, perhaps in the High Court?
Yes, you can. Despite the finality clause, the High Court's power of judicial review under Article 226 of the Constitution means that writ petitions are maintainable against orders of statutory tribunals, like the Municipal Building Tribunal.
But is it easy to get the High Court involved?
Not necessarily. The courts are generally reluctant to interfere if there's an effective alternative remedy available, which the tribunal is supposed to be. However, they will intervene in certain situations.
Such as?
For instance, if it appears the municipality is failing to perform its public duty, maybe due to irrelevant or suspicious reasons, or if their action seems completely arbitrary or capricious, or critically, if there is evidence suggesting the authorities might be colluding with illegal builders, effectively turning a blind eye. In those kinds of cases, the High Court is more likely to step in.
So for exceptional circumstances, basically, what general principles have emerged from court rulings on these matters?
The courts, both the Calcutta High Court and the Supreme Court of India, have been very consistent on a few key points. Firstly, there's a huge emphasis on due process and procedural fairness.
We talked about the show cause notice.
Exactly. The Supreme Court, in particular, has strongly condemned demolishing homes without following due process. They've used strong language, saying things like, "Bulldozer justice is unknown to any civilized society." In some cases, they've even directed compensation be paid to homeowners whose properties were demolished unfairly.
So process is paramount. But what about the person who deliberately broke the rules?
Ah, that's the other side of the coin. There's a very strong principle. Equity does not favor a person making unauthorized construction. If you deliberately violate the law, you can't really expect the court's sympathy or assistance.
Ties back to the limited scope for regularization.
Precisely. Regularization, as we said, is only for those minor, insignificant, accidental violations, not for deliberate, reckless, or motivated ones. The courts see regularization as a rare exception, definitely not the rule.
What about the rights of neighbors we discussed earlier?
The courts have upheld that. An adjoining owner does have a right to object if a sanctioned plan violates rules about things like how much area can be built or the required open spaces, because those violations inherently affect their rights, like light and air.
Okay. And this is a really important one for listeners. What happens to people who buy flats in buildings that turn out to be illegally constructed?
This is a harsh reality, but the legal position is generally quite stark. Flat purchasers, whether they knew about the illegality or not when they bought, usually have no locus standing, no legal right to challenge a demolition order against the illegal structure itself. They typically cannot seek regularization of the part they bought.
So they can lose their home even if they bought in good faith?
Potentially, yes. Their primary and often only available legal remedy is to sue the developer or the person who sold them the flat, seeking a refund of their money and possibly damages for the loss suffered.
That's a tough lesson. Buyer beware indeed.
Very much so. Due diligence before buying is absolutely critical. And one last point on enforcement. The police have a statutory obligation to assist the corporation in carrying out demolition orders if needed.
Okay. So, to sum up the strategy if you're facing demolition, first, use the statutory remedy, the appeal to the tribunal.
Yes, exhaust that first.
Then, focus on any procedural flaws. Was the notice proper? Were you given a fair chance to respond?
Crucial. Challenge any procedural lapses.
Try to argue, if applicable, that the deviation is genuinely minor and unintentional.
If the facts support it, yes. That's where the slim chance of regularization lies.
And only in extreme cases of arbitrariness or lack of jurisdiction, consider approaching the high court via a writ petition.
That's generally the hierarchy of remedies.
Right. Now, before we wrap up, there's one more specific wrinkle in Kolkata's property law we need to touch upon briefly. Theka tenancy properties. This sounds quite unique.
It is quite unique to Kolkata and some surrounding areas. It's a specific type of land tenure where traditionally a landlord leases out vacant land to a tenant, and the tenant is explicitly allowed to erect temporary structures, often called kucha structures.
So the tenant builds but doesn't own the land.
Correct. The tenant owns the structure they build, but the land belongs to the landlord, or now often the state, due to legislative changes. It creates a distinct legal landscape.
How does this interact with the KMC building rules we've been discussing?
This is the critical point. It adds another layer of regulation. Even if you manage to get a building plan sanctioned by the KMC for construction on Theka tenanted land, you also need prior permission from a separate authority called the Theka controller for any erection, addition, or alteration of a structure on that land.
So KMC approval isn't enough on its own for these properties.
No, you need both. Historically, construction on Theka land was very restricted, mostly just those temporary structures. But things have evolved.
How so?
Amendments to the Theka tenancy legislation, like one in 2019, now allow Theka tenants themselves to undertake constructions up to 5 stories, subject to approvals. And the Kolkata Metropolitan Development Authority, the KMDA, can also now construct multi-storied buildings on Theka lands, often for rehabilitation purposes.
So it's becoming more integrated into formal development, but the dual approval remains.
Yes, and here's the crucial caution. If you get a KMC sanction for construction on Theka land, but you didn't get the necessary prior permission from the Theka controller, that KMC sanction could potentially be rendered voidable or invalid.
Meaning the whole project could be stopped or even demolished later, even with KMC papers in hand.
That's the risk. It really highlights how specific local land laws can create unforeseen complexities and add layers of regulatory hurdles you need to navigate carefully. It's a very Kolkata-specific issue.
Fascinating. Okay, so we have covered a lot of ground today. This deep dive into the KMC Act of 1980 really shows it as a pretty robust framework, doesn't it? It's trying to balance planned urban development and public safety with that essential need for due process.
Absolutely. And we've seen how its enforcement has had to evolve over time, expanding committees, moving processes online, even changing demolition tactics, reflecting the city's ongoing struggle and adaptation to manage urban growth and illegal construction.
And we touched upon those unique complexities like Theka tenancy, adding another layer to the story.
Ultimately, understanding these regulations, even at a basic level, is just indispensable for anyone involved in Kolkata's urban landscape. Whether you're a homeowner, a renter, a developer, or a legal professional, these rules shape the physical city and impact safety and rights.
It truly underpins the integrity of how the city is built and maintained. So here's a final thought for you, our listener, to maybe chew on. Given this clear legal stance against deliberate violations and the strict accountability placed on building professionals, how do you think a city like Kolkata can truly balance the pressures of rapid urban development with a rigorous, uncompromised adherence to safety and planning regulations, especially when dealing with the vast number of existing structures already built?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? How to manage the future while dealing with the legacy of the past?
Something to ponder. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.